Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're going back in time a little bit.
Back in time.
To 1980.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. With an episode of Milton Friedman's Free to Choose.
Okay.
Called Who Protects the Worker? And, you know, it's funny because this episode is from decades ago.
Yeah.
But it's still so relevant today.
It is.
And it asks these questions about, you know, the role of unions, government intervention,
right.
Free markets,
mm-hmm.
and really what creates, you know, a fair, thriving workplace.
Yeah. And who or what is best equipped to protect the worker?
Right. And that's the big question, right?
Yeah.
Who protects the worker? Is it the unions?
Right.
Is it the government? Is it the free market?
Yeah.
I mean, and it's so interesting because we have Milton Friedman, who is, you know, a champion for free markets.
Absolutely.
Going head to head with an actual union leader.
Yes.
Lynn Williams.
Yep.
And Friedman really argues that it's the free market,
yep.
not unions or government, that actually protects the worker.
Yeah. You know what I think is really striking is that even though this episode is from, you know, a different era,
yeah.
it tackles questions about the things we're still grappling with today.
Yeah.
About, you know, the workplace.
Totally.
So it's really fascinating to see how these ideas have stood the test of time.
Right. And how they've evolved or haven't evolved.
Exactly.
So one of the things that Friedman starts off with is this analogy. And it's kind of a surprising one.
Okay.
He connects ancient Greek medical practices.
Oh, what?
To modern unions.
Interesting.
Yeah. And he points out that the Hippocratic Oath, which was designed to protect patients,
right.
also had these clauses that basically created a closed shop among doctors.
Okay, so can we break down closed shop for a sec?
Yeah, what does that even mean?
So a closed shop basically means that to work in a specific field, you have to be a member of a union.
Got it.
It's like saying you can't be a plumber unless you're in the plumber's union.
Ah, okay, so he's kind of saying that even way back then, professional groups used these agreements mm-hmm. to control who could practice.
Yes.
Kind of like unions today.
Exactly.
But then how does he connect that to protecting workers?
So he argues that unions, just like those professional organizations,
okay.
often use their power to restrict entry into a profession.
Mm-hmm.
And that can drive up costs and even harm consumers.
Interesting.
So he uses this example of paramedics, you know, who often provide excellent care.
Yeah.
But they face pushback from these established medical groups who might feel threatened by them being there.
Interesting. So it's about competition.
Yeah.
He's basically saying that more competition in the job market is good for workers.
Exactly.
Because it gives employers more choices.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to offer better wages and better conditions to attract the best people.
Yeah, because if they don't, someone else will.
Right.
So it really puts pressure on them to step up their game.
Okay, I can see that. But doesn't he also talk about times when unions haven't really been the good guys?
He does.
Like where they've done things that are maybe not so great?
Yeah, he brings up some pretty dramatic examples of conflict.
Like what?
Between union and non-union workers.
Okay.
Like, there's this incident at a coal loading dock
uh-huh.
where armed union members attacked people who chose to work during a strike.
Wow.
So he's saying that while unions can advocate for workers,
right.
sometimes their actions can be coercive and even violent, especially when their power is challenged.
Yikes, that's not a good look.
No, not at all.
So, okay, so that's unions. What about the government? What does he think about the role of government in all this?
He's pretty critical of government intervention, especially when it comes to things like minimum wage laws.
Okay.
He actually argues that minimum wage, although is often seen as a way to help the poor,
mm-hmm.
can actually harm them.
What? Yeah. How does that work?
So the thinking is that a higher minimum wage means more money for those who are, you know, lower skilled workers.
Right.
But he says that by raising the cost of labor, businesses are less likely to hire people without experience.
Oh, I see.
Especially, you know, young people, minorities, people who are just starting out.
So he's saying that those good intentions can backfire.
Exactly.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
He believes that government intervention, even when it's well-intentioned, can have unintended consequences
yeah.
that can actually hurt the people it's trying to help.
Okay, so we've talked about his critique of unions. We've yeah. talked about his critique of government.
Right.
What is his solution?
So this is where his free market philosophy really comes in.
Okay.
He uses the example of Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Okay.
Which is a town that embraced free trade.
Okay.
They cut taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And they advertise themselves as open for business.
So they went all in on this free market approach.
They did.
And what happened?
Well, the results were pretty remarkable.
Really?
They saw a huge surge in investment.
Wow.
Job creation.
Okay.
Higher wages for workers.
It worked.
It did. And he uses this example to illustrate his belief that a truly free market where businesses have to compete for workers and workers have lots of choices is the most effective way to ensure that workers are doing well.
So he's saying that instead of relying on unions or government handouts, individuals can thrive in a competitive market through their own efforts.
Exactly.
Okay.
He even shares the story of Mr. Juma, a Ugandan refugee who came to Spartanburg with very little.
Wow.
And was able to build a successful life thanks to the opportunities provided by a free market.
That's amazing.
It is.
That's a really inspiring story.
It is.
But does he acknowledge that, you know, not everyone can be Mr. Juma?
That's a great question.
Like, what about people who face discrimination?
Mm-hmm.
Or they don't have access to education and resources?
Right. And that leads us into the heart of the debate between Friedman and Lynn Williams, which we'll explore in the next part of our deep dive. Things get really interesting when Friedman's ideas about the free market get challenged.
Okay.
One guest brings up the Great Depression.
Oh.
And argues that, you know, this economic turmoil
proves that a free market without unions could be disastrous for workers.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the Great Depression was a really rough time for everyone.
It was.
Especially workers.
Yeah.
How does Friedman respond to that?
He doesn't back down at all.
Okay.
He argues that the Great Depression wasn't a failure of capitalism.
Okay.
But a result of too much government intervention.
Wow. So he's saying the government made it worse.
Yeah. And he even goes on to say that the prosperity of American workers has come about not because of unions, but in spite of them.
Wow, he's really doubling down.
He is.
How does he justify that? I mean, especially given, you know, the whole history of unions fighting for things like better working conditions and fair wages.
He does acknowledge that unions have played a role in advocating for workers.
Okay.
But he thinks their influence has been overstated.
Okay.
He points out that unions have never represented more than a quarter of American workers.
So he's acknowledging their existence, but not necessarily their effectiveness.
Right, not on a large scale. Okay, what does Lynn Williams, the union leader, have to say about all this?
He argues that the Industrial Revolution, while it brought progress, also created a situation where many workers weren't getting their fair share.
Okay.
And he sees unions as a necessary response to this power imbalance between workers and employers.
So it's about leveling the playing field.
Exactly.
He's saying unions gave workers a voice in a system that was often stacked against them.
That's right. He credits unions with improving working conditions.
Okay.
Raising wages and giving workers a say in their own destinies.
I mean, this is where it gets really interesting for me because we have these two very different perspectives.
Yeah.
Friedman emphasizing individual freedom, and Williams focused on collective action.
Right.
It's like this fundamental tension at the heart of the debate.
It is, and it's a tension that we still see playing out today.
Totally.
You know, this question of whether workers are better served by individual initiative within a free market or by collective bargaining through unions is one that doesn't have an easy answer.
Yeah. And then the conversation shifts to immigration, which adds another layer of complexity to the issue.
It does.
Of worker protection.
Yeah. Friedman actually supports open borders in principle.
Okay.
But he raises concerns about how open immigration might impact the welfare state.
Okay. How so?
He's worried that people might come to the U.S. mainly to take advantage of benefits.
Oh, okay.
Rather than seeking employment.
I see.
It's a tough issue.
It is.
You have this ideal of free movement of people.
Right.
But then there's this potential strain on social safety nets.
Yeah. If too many people come looking for help instead of work.
Exactly. It's a real dilemma.
It is.
And Friedman points out the complicated situation of undocumented workers.
Yeah.
Like those working on California farms.
Okay.
He acknowledges that these workers contribute to the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And often earn more than minimum wage.
Right.
But their status makes them vulnerable.
Right.
They're working outside the legal framework of the country.
So even though they're contributing, their lack of legal status kind of puts them in a position where they can be exploited?
Exactly. And this ties back into his argument about minimum wage.
Oh, okay.
He's advocating for completely getting rid of minimum wage laws.
Wow. Okay.
He believes they do more harm than good, especially for low-skilled workers.
Okay.
including, you know, minorities and young people.
Didn't we already talk about this?
We did.
Why is he bringing it up again?
Well, this time it leads to this heated exchange with Lynn Williams,
who
argues that minimum wage laws are essential to protect workers from exploitation and to ensure a basic standard of living.
So it's like a classic clash of ideologies.
It is.
Williams sees minimum wage as a safety net,
mm-hmm.
and Friedman sees it as this barrier to entry for people who are just starting out.
Exactly. And Friedman even challenges Williams. He asks, why don't unions push for even higher minimum wages?
Okay.
Like $10 an hour or even $200 an hour?
Wow.
He's saying, if raising the minimum wage is such a good way to help people, why not make it even higher?
So he's calling their bluff.
He is.
Pointing out what he sees as this flaw in their logic.
Exactly. He sees it as this arbitrary intervention in the market that ends up hurting the very people it's supposed to help.
I see where he's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But I can also understand the concerns about, you know, worker exploitation if there were no minimum wage laws.
And that's where the other guests jump in.
Oh.
Some siding with Friedman, some siding with Williams.
Okay.
There's this back and forth about the historical impact of unions,
mm-hmm.
the role of government in the labor market.
Okay.
The balance between individual freedom and collective action.
Sounds complicated.
It really highlights how nuanced and complex these issues are.
Yeah.
One point that's particularly interesting is about who really benefits from minimum wage laws.
Okay.
Friedman argues that unions are often the biggest supporters.
Really?
Not because it helps their members.
Okay.
But because it protects them from competition from lower skilled workers.
Right. Wait, is he saying that unions are using minimum wage to keep non-union workers out?
That's his argument.
Wow. Okay.
He claims that unions sometimes use these laws to create a barrier to entry for non-union workers.
Okay.
Essentially limiting competition in their favor.
That's a pretty bold accusation.
It is.
What evidence does he have to support that?
He points to examples from other countries like South Africa,
okay.
where unions have openly advocated for minimum wage and equal pay for equal work as a way to protect white jobs from competition.
Wow. Okay. So that adds a whole new dimension to the minimum wage debate.
It does.
It's not just about ensuring a living wage, but also about how these policies could be used for exclusionary purposes.
Exactly. It really complicates the narrative.
It does.
And forces us to consider the potential unintended consequences of even well-intentioned policies.
Okay. So we've got this back and forth about unions and minimum wage and the role of government.
Mm-hmm.
What about Friedman's vision of a free market utopia?
Like we saw in Spartanburg.
Yeah.
He suggests that if the whole U.S. embraced those free market policies, it would lead to greater prosperity for everyone.
So everyone would be better off.
That's what he thinks. He envisions a system where employers compete for workers.
Okay.
And workers are free to choose the best opportunities.
Okay.
Leading to a more dynamic and productive economy.
I mean, that sounds a bit idealistic, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, what about worker exploitation?
Mm.
What about this potential race to the bottom with businesses just cutting corners to maximize profits?
That's exactly the counterargument that the other guests bring up.
Okay.
They believe that government regulations and worker protections are essential to ensure fairness and prevent abuse.
Okay.
They argue that a completely unfettered free market could leave workers vulnerable without adequate safeguards.
So we end up right back at that fundamental question.
Yeah.
Who protects the worker?
Right. Is it the invisible hand of the free market?
Mm-hmm.
The collective power of unions?
Or the regulations and policies set by the government?
Right.
And the episode doesn't really give us a definitive answer.
Okay.
It leaves us with more questions than answers.
Yeah.
But does force us to confront these questions head on and to think about the trade-offs involved in different approaches to worker protection.
I think it's clear that there are valid arguments on all sides.
There are.
The challenge is to find that sweet spot, that balance that promotes both individual opportunity and collective well-being, recognizing that both freedom and fairness are important.
Absolutely. And that's a challenge that's still with us today.
Yeah.
You know, we see it in the ongoing debates about minimum wage hikes, the gig economy, to work laws, and the role of unions in the 21st century.
You know, it's amazing to me how an episode from 1980 can still feel so relevant
it does.
To the conversations we're having today about work,
yeah,
about freedom. about prosperity, right? It's like these fundamental questions.
Yeah.
They're timeless in a way.
They really are.
You know, we've been wrestling with them for centuries.
Yeah. So what does all this mean for us?
Yeah.
Like, as listeners, what can we actually take away?
Yeah. I think the biggest takeaway is that there are no easy answers.
Right.
Whether you agree more with Friedman's free market approach or Williams's emphasis on collective bargaining.
Right.
Just understanding the complexities of these issues is so crucial.
Yeah.
We have to think critically about the potential consequences of different policies and approaches.
It's a reminder that we all have a role to play.
We do.
In shaping the future of work.
Right.
Whether we're workers, employers, consumers, or policymakers, our choices have an impact.
Absolutely.
You know, and we've talked about this story of Mr. Juma.
Yeah.
That Ugandan refugee who found success in Spartanburg.
It's an inspiring story.
It is.
It shows that individual initiative and a belief in opportunity can make a real difference.
Yeah. But it's also important to remember that not everyone starts from the same place.
Right.
Not everyone has access to the same resources.
That's true.
So finding that balance, I think, is key.
It is.
Creating a system that allows for individual success and collective well-being.
Yeah.
Where freedom and fairness can coexist.
Exactly. And it's an ongoing process.
Yeah.
We need to keep striving for that balance.
Right.
Through, you know, open and honest debate.
Yeah.
Thoughtful policymaking.
Right.
And a willingness to consider different perspectives.
I feel like I've learned a lot from this deep dive.
Me too.
It's given me a lot to think about.
It's a reminder that even a TV episode from decades ago can spark new insights and provoke discussions that are still relevant today.
Absolutely. If you're interested in exploring this topic further, I highly recommend checking out the full episode of Free to Choose, Who Protects the Worker?
Yeah, it's thought-provoking.
It really is.
And as you're reflecting on these ideas, think about, you know, the world around you. Mm-hmm. What policies are impacting workers in your own community?
Yeah.
How can you advocate for policies that promote both individual opportunity and collective well-being?
That's a great point. The power to shape the future of work isn't just in the hands of politicians and CEOs.
Right.
It's in all of our hands.
So as you go about your day.
Yeah.
Think about the choices you make as a consumer, as a worker, as a citizen.
Mm.
Every action, big or small, can contribute to creating a more just and prosperous society for everyone.
I love that. And that's a great note to end on.
Yeah, it is.
Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me.